You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today you'll be seeing a recording of a conversation I had a few days ago with a gentleman named Vince Venata, local to the area I live in. I live in Powell. He lives in the next town over, Cody, Wyoming. And this conversation is more political than I think than most of the conversations I've had on the podcast, and quite specifically so. Vince is retired from the United States Marine Corps. He stayed in for 22 plus years, been deployed numerous times. He is a master, was retired as a master sergeant. I reached out to Vince and we have something in common. Folks who know me suggested that I not have this conversation with Vince. Apparently folks that who knows Vince suggested to him that this was a bad idea to do a podcast talking about things with somebody who's, I don't know if we're on the opposite side of the political aisle, but, we're certainly not in lockstep. Had a great conversation. I think we spoke about Vince's time in the Marines, his struggles with PTSD afterwards, and then got into a couple of political issues, got into conversations about political issues. I hope there's a next. So I really enjoyed my conversation with Vince, and I hope you appreciate it. Especially now when we're living in this ridiculously polarized times, having conversations with people that you don't necessarily agree with everything on is what needs to happen. And so now more than ever, I am so glad you're here. So thanks for doing that. And thanks for putting up with me and the question and spending this time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Very welcome. Yeah, yeah, it was difficult trying to get me locked on during the summertime because as our first conversation, I was out camping. And
yes, that's right.
I remember my wife and I try to spend the summer outside of the house. So
that's
now we're coming into winter and
everybody's hunkering down.
Here we are.
Exactly. So you went into the Marines at how old were you?
I signed up. I was 18 years old in 1981, and then left for that incredible recreation facility called Marine Corps Recruit Depot, Parris Island, in January of '82 for boot camp, and then actually did one enlistment and got out of the Marine Corps and went back to New York City. And that's where I'm originally from, is New York City.
Really?
Yeah. And then that's how I knew about Canisius, speaking about that video thing. But the went back, and I was out of the Marine Corps for 89 days and had reenlisted and ended up spending just short of 22 years. So it was 21 years, 8 months, and change.
In the Marines.
Made it a career.
Right. And okay, so, and I know, let me just say, I know, well, we have a limited time. And Vince already gave me permission in one of our phone calls to say, you know, I can go down a rabbit hole. So, you know, pull me back if we're spending too much time someplace. So if I seem ruder than usual, I just want you to know I got permission. So
walk away.
Yeah, really. Well, I want to also, well, couple things. Would you say that being in the Marine Corps instilled values in you that are sort of alive and well today, or did you join the Marine Corps with those values and they just got strengthened? I mean, were you a kid just looking for something to do and looking for action, or did you join because you believed in something? And you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, I was one of those kids. I used to, on Saturday mornings in New York, they used to play, the war movies in black and white, Sands of Iwo Jima, things like that. And I used to watch those movies. And, and I don't come from a military family. I mean, my father had been in the Army, and my uncle had been in the Army. He was killed in Korea. And then a second cousin had been in the Navy in World War II. But we weren't, a military family. I was not a military brat. And quite frankly, I mean, I joined the Marines because after graduating high school, I delayed going to college. I actually had aspirations of going to college, and I delayed it. And between the people I was hanging out with as a kid, as a teenager, I was 18 years old. I was hanging out with these guys, and I just I came to a realization that this is going to go nowhere fast. And
nowhere good.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
I was hanging out with a bunch of tough guys.
Yeah.
And I just decided I needed to get away. And one day I was at work, and I used to work at Saks Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, on the loading dock, not inside. And I was bringing things into the sub basement, and I saw all these people in there working, and they were just doing this manual labor and, nothing strenuous, but printing out labels. And, there were a bunch of these old people. Gosh, they must have been in their 50s. I don't know. Who'd ever thought I'd be there, right?
Real
yeah,
old.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Real old. I was 18. And I just thought, I can't do this the rest of my life. I've got to go do something different.
Right.
So I joined the Marines and went in blindly and essentially was looking for a challenge. That's when the shaping of my value system and my, becoming a principled individual and looking at the big picture of things really started to hit home and started to shape me as an adult.
And did that, when you look back at it, I was about to use the word distance, but I don't mean that. Was it dissimilar from the value system of your parents? And like, did you suddenly feel like a fish out of water, or did they see you suddenly as, something happened? Sent away this kid, and now we've got something else.
No, actually, my mother and father were separated, he left when I was 9 years old. But my mother was very proud of the fact that I had joined the Marines, and I didn't fully recognize the issue of, the world that I was in as a Marine until literally I was out in the field in Korea on a mountaintop, and we got a teletype message that came in that had elevated us in DEFCON, and it looked like we were getting ready to go to war with the Soviet Union.
Real. Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is real. This is the real adult world. And this is not training. This is this is real. And so that, that was for me, that was a point that impacted me, and we're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah.
And but back then, I mean, we didn't have the internet. I spent a lot of time overseas and didn't have that ability to call home. So when my mother did see me when I would come home to visit on leave, I was a different person. She didn't recognize. I mean, I used to have hair down in the middle of my back, bald on top now. And
didn't have hair down your back in Korea.
not in the Marines. So the I came home. I was a different person, and she was very proud of the fact of what I was doing.
But it was a person she didn't. I mean, it wasn't like stay away. It was a person she respected.
Yeah, she was proud of the fact that, you know, I was in the Marines, I was self-sufficient, and living on my own and traveling. Mm-hmm. And she was very proud of the fact that you know, she raised me, and I was not calling home saying, "Mom, I need money."
Right. Right. So. And had she wanted you to go to college? Like, was it part of the, like, you know, you graduate high school? Were you in a family where you graduate high school and the expectation is you're going to go off to college, or, you know, there was a world, the world is your oyster. You can do a lot of different things.
Actually, I was the first person in my family to graduate high school. So the expectation of college was not really there.
Not really?
Yeah. The expectation was, or the hope was, to graduate high school.
Yeah.
You know, our family immigrated, you know, depending upon which part of the family, in the 1800s, Italian and Irish. And, you know, my mother, for instance, I think the highest grade she got through was the ninth grade.
Yeah.
And, you know, when her father died, she was expected to go to work, along with her brother and her sister.
Sure. Right.
You know, my father's side, he didn't graduate either. And he went to work and bring money into the family to provide.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, by her suffering and sacrificing, you know, financially, she sent my brother and I to Catholic elementary school. And then I ended up going to a Catholic high school. And my brother went to a vocational technical high school. And, I have two brothers, and we all graduated high school. And
got it.
She was happy for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you made mention of the sort of the values that you acquired in the Marines, and at least in one of our conversations. And you just said, you know, a moment ago, it's like, you know, be a principled person and look at the big picture. And I mean, are there other things that you would describe as values that the Marines sort of gave you?
Well, one of the things that they kind of took away was, you know, emotions were important, but you really didn't put them into the equation when it came to moving forward on your mission and your goals. So kind of suppressed a lot of the emotional side of things. Seemed to make me more focused on the goals, the mission, that type of thing. And it, you know, it gave me a sense and an understanding that, you know, the principles that the Marine Corps and the values that system that the Marine Corps was promoting was very important towards the success of the mission. And granted, there's missions at all different levels, but, you know, sure, the mission of the Marine Corps. So it was very, very important in that respect that to uphold those. And, you know, we as Marines, we held each other accountable. So we're looking even beyond the command structure side of things of holding people accountable. We held each other accountable to maintain the standards and the values and the principles that were before us. And so it was a learning curve in the beginning, but once you understood it and you worked very hard to uphold those things.
And geez, I don't even know how to ask this question, but like, did you or you and your buddies, when you were in, did you have a sense that the folks who weren't were, you know, were full citizens and they may not have been doing the things you were doing, but they were legitimate, I don't even know what words to use, Americans worthy of respect, protection, etc.? Or was there a sense that, you know, if you hadn't served, or if you didn't serve, or if whatever it was, if you, there was a problem with that? But
yeah, you're talking about the slimy civilians, right?
Yes, right.
And we would jokingly say that, but the fact of the matter is, you know, a very small part of our population serves in the military.
Sure, I know.
And let's face it, the military is not for everybody. It's like law enforcement. It's not for everybody. Artistry is not for everybody. People have to find their niche in life, what to go in, what to excel in, what to enjoy. And so, you know, I can say I didn't look down upon those people who didn't serve.
Interesting.
Those people who were appreciative of us who were serving was a good thing. I appreciated the support that we got from people in the community.
Okay, so can we shift and again, like sure. I said to you on the phone, you know, if we get someplace where you don't want to talk about it, you'll just tell me I'm not talking about it. But but I know that, and we spoke about this, when you got out of the Marines, things were different. I think this is the way I read it. You were undiagnosed, a person, suffering from, but a person with PTSD, post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And for a while, at least I think I told you I read your testimony, yours and your wife's testimony in front of that subcommittee. And for a while, you know, you weren't getting the care support that was helpful. In fact, I don't even think the diagnosis came until much later, right? That you'd had severe PTSD and it wasn't diagnosed until years later. And has that changed? Not necessarily for you, but I mean, is some of that Wyoming? Is some of that just military care that the VA does not require? And what is it that was ultimately helpful?
Well, you know, we obviously don't have enough time to do a deep dive on that, but the PTSD. Other thing that has occurred is the VA, I believe, was not prepared for the number of people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, because those were the two major things going on when I was right before I left the Marines. I went into Iraq in March of 2003 for the invasion. But the number of veterans, service members who were coming back, we had a tremendous amount of veterans servicemen and women who were injured and survived their injuries, as compared to, you know, the last major conflict that we were in. I'm not going to say Vietnam, not to minimize Desert Storm, Desert Shield, but that was so short. But when you look at Vietnam, I think it was 55,000 killed in that war.
Yeah.
And the way it's been explained to me, the numbers have flipped now. So we're looking at about 55,000 to 60,000 servicemen and women who were injured in theater, and about 5,000 killed in action as a result of those wars. So I don't think the VA system was prepared to deal with those types of numbers, that huge influx, plus the residual numbers of, you still had World War II veterans who were significantly elderly at that point, Korea, Vietnam, those veterans who served in those conflicts in the 80s that just stormed as a shield and then moving into Iraq and Afghanistan. So I don't think they were prepared. And it was a steep learning curve, I believe, for them. But, you know, the turning point for me was actually a civilian organization. I went through a treatment program with UCLA Operation Mend in Los Angeles. And, man, it was huge. What an eye-opener. And it taught me how to look at things from a perspective where I didn't view it as something was my fault, where, you know, if somebody had gotten hurt, it wasn't my fault. It was because, hey, it was it was going to happen.
Yes.
So it was a huge game changer in that respect. And, you know, and the VA has gotten significantly better. And
that's,
you
know, nice to hear that. Yeah.
What they're doing and what they're trying to do. And, you know, and their modalities are changing again as they move along. But, you know, a lot of men and women who with PTSD were being treated as if they were depressed, and they weren't depressed. It was PTSD, which is completely different. Mm-hmm. So by giving them antidepressants, they were actually making them depressed, because antidepressants are actually a depressant. And so it was making people depressed because they weren't depressed. They had PTSD. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's it was a game changer in 2020 with UCLA Operation Mend. Fantastic group of people.
Okay, wait. So just so I have the timing. So you left in 2003.
Yeah, 17 years later.
So that's a long time to long time to deal with. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it actually took me 7 years to actually go out and try and start trying to figure out what's going on here.
And why do you think that was? Is there, I mean, you know, maybe I'm fishing. I'm not really, you know, there is a, I've heard it expressed by mostly local psychologists, counselors, et cetera, there's an ethos of sort of, you know, you're supposed to deal with, you know, you see a physical injury, it's real. Injuries that are invisible, that, you know, especially if they deal with emotional issues, there's a sort of Wyoming cowboy up attitude that one is supposed to adopt. This is coming not from me, but from counselor types who kind of feel like there is a, you know, there's an attitude that says you're supposed to do that stuff. You're supposed to keep that stuff to yourself, organize it yourself, handle it yourself. And I'm wondering if in hindsight you felt like that was part of why it took you either 7 years to start looking for something, or, and that many years, 17 years to find the right program.
I mean, it's a mindset of, you know, suck it up, buttercup, you know, pain is weakness leaving the body. Right. And, you know, right. you just suck it up and move on. And there's nothing wrong with me. It's everybody else who screwed up. And it was, you know, it's been a huge learning curve. And, but, you know, one of the defining points was in 2014, I had three people I knew, two of them were friends, who took their lives. All three of them shot themselves. And, you know, it was terrible. And that was the year that Wounded Warrior Project invited me to testify at that the Senate Subcommittee on Mental Health Issues and the Veterans Administration. So that was the year that made me realize, you know what? Houston, we might have a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that it took that long to find the right sort of program. Is the Wounded Warriors problem? I mean, with the Wounded Warriors program, is it still alive and well and active?
Wounded Warrior Project is. It is moving along really well. It's had to change. You know, the veterans that they serve, they're veterans, they're members. You know, they call them warriors. They're changing. They're getting older. You know, some of them are into their 60s like me now, and and so it's changing, and so they've had to change, and but they've done a lot of good, and they've really focused on long-term care for those who are severely injured, and they've also focused on trying to get those veterans who have, you know, the invisible injuries or physical injuries, engaged and active again. Mm-hmm. So they're doing what they can, yeah, and trying to be part of the solution for, you know, the veterans who served our country.
And I maybe have this wrong. When you walked out of that theater with Gabriel, I got that right?
The dog.
He had a harness. Did he have a support dog or whatever they call those?
He's a trained service dog.
He's a trained service dog.
So he was wearing a vest that identifies him as a service dog, and and it had the desert camouflage pattern vest, which was actually two of my uniform blouses that a lady in North Carolina had crafted into a vest. So he's wearing my uniform now, or wait, part of it.
What's the service part? What's the service part? What does he do?
He's trained to do a number of things. The big thing is, if I'm having, bad dreams, or some people call them night terrors or something like that, he'll wake me up in the middle of the night. If anxiety starts to feel anxious about stuff, he'll push, if we're standing there, he'll push into my leg and kind of let me know that he's there. And it's kind of like a distracting type thing.
So he is part of, well, I don't know if they're right, the right word, treatment or part of the therapeutic practice having to do with your PTSD?
He is, and not prescribed. This was something my wife had discovered, and it's an organization in Washington State called Northwest Battle Buddies, and they provide professionally trained service dogs to combat veterans. And so my wife, out of desperation, trying to fix me, and my wife has been huge in this endeavor of trying to get me back
to you,
to the way I was.
Yeah.
She introduced me to these people, and I said, okay, yeah, sure, let's try it. And a phrase I kind of coined was pause before pills. And so it's been a neat journey. So I've had him since 2015.
Oh, wow.
It's a game changer. It really is. And, to kind of pay it back, my wife was a volunteer with the organization for a number of years. And now she actually works for them.
Is your dog with you all the time? You keep him around all the time? You go
most of the time. He's 11 and a half now. Mm. So as he's getting older, sometimes it's not. You have to look at the circumstances, but I'd say probably 90% of the time he's around.
That's great. That is terrific. Well, thanks for being willing to talk about that. And I think it's, I hope people hear it. So we're going to shift gears again and
push the clutch in and let's go.
Yeah. So, all right. Did you have a political orientation before you joined the Marines? Or no, you were just a kid in school and growing up, and
when I turned old enough to vote, when I turned 18, I asked my mother, I said, what's the difference between a Democrat and a Republican? And she said, Democrats work for a living. They're blue collar. Republicans are white collar. She goes, we're Democrats. You go register as a Democrat. Okay.
And you did.
So I did.
Because mom said, after all.
And, and I was a Democrat for a number of years, and, but really not politically involved. Yeah. Not at all. Yeah. I'd say I probably didn't start looking at things from a political perspective until when George W. Bush, ran for office. That's when I started seriously looking at, politics. Before that, during the Clinton years, I was aware of things that were going on, but quite frankly, I was in the Marines. I didn't have time.
I was about to say it's all consuming, right?
Yeah. And I had two young kids. I didn't have time between being gone a lot in the field and raising children. I didn't have the time to be involved in politics. But when George W. Bush that year when he ran, I started to become more aware of what was going on and started to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
When I say getting involved, start formulating my opinions and my position on issues, of course. And after I retired from the Marines, that was a different story. It enabled me to get involved.
And are you now, well, involved? What does involved mean there? I mean, aware but also involved?
Well, expressing my opinion openly, getting involved. I mean, I'm in the Republican Party. I don't remember what year I changed from Democrat to Republican. And, actually involved in the Republican Party, became a precinct committee man, got involved in the executive committees, treasurer, vice chairman, state committee man on the Wyoming GOP's executive committee.
Are you still involved in those things?
Oh, very much so. Oh, yeah. Very involved. Just got reelected in August for as precinct committee man. And right now I'm a state committee man and a district rep with the Wyoming GOP's executive committee. So, yeah, I'm involved. Go to the conventions, help craft, bylaws, platforms, resolutions, those things. Stay very involved.
And would you say that the values that were fostered within the military and the values you came out with have affected your political orientation? Or a lot of Marines who are Democrats?
I do know quite a few Marines who are Democrats.
And can you guys have civil conversations with each other? So what?
Quite frankly, I can have a civil conversation with anyone. I actually enjoy having conversations with people now, and I love having conversations of differing opinions, because when you have differing opinions and you're able to talk about things, you're actually able to learn off each other, and potentially change your mind on something. But it's when those things devolve into arguments, or that's when things get bad and it becomes counterproductive.
I would add to that, I would have put a footnote on there, is like, it's not even that, it's more than the arguments. It's like some people can argue and it's healthy, and other people, what an argument means I'm going to dig my heels in and not listen, right? I don't want to change my mind. I'm not willing to open my mind. I'm not willing to listen to another point of view. And I think that's where so much of the country is right now.
It's terrible. The country right now is terribly divisive.
It's unbelievable.
It's scary is what it is. I talk to people, some on the extreme right, some middle of the road, some on the extreme left. And, some of the things that I've seen and some of the things I've heard are very unsettling. For instance, I spent time in Portland because my wife works in Southern Washington, and we go out there periodically. But I saw all the rioting, the Antifa rioting in Portland. And then, coincidentally, I was in Kenosha when that whole
Wisconsin
thing occurred. We were there actually for a wedding, and as I was driving out of Kenosha proper, out of the city there, I noticed all these military vehicles, which I imagine were National Guard and black sedans and police vehicles coming in. I said, "Well, I guess I picked a good time to get out of here," but it was a. In a way, it was really disconcerting, because this is the United States of America. This is the land. This is the home of the free. This is the melting pot. This is where so many cultures have come seeking freedom. And this was tantamount to a war zone of civil disturbance. And where you had people of differing mindsets taking it to the extreme.
I was about to say, willing to go to some extreme. Yeah. And it's crazy. It strikes me as just an insanity that's come, it's a crazy time to try and have a conversation about things because people can't even, they don't even want to have a conversation about what counts as facts, right? I mean,
I just believe anger blinds people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, that's disconcerting that when you see people getting to that level of anger and willing to destroy property and
destroy people.
And as it got to the point, as we saw in Kenosha, I mean, it went from injuring people to people actually getting shot dying. And the same thing in Portland, where people were getting severely injured and people doing things with intent and with malice.
Kenosha was horrible. I mean, there are a bunch of those things on the list, right? You know, January 6th was hot at the Capitol, was horrible. It was like Portland. I mean, we have relatives who moved out of Portland. They left. They're in Chicago now. They left. They went first to Seattle and then got out of there because it was, you know, terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And terrible at the level of, okay, it's no longer safe to be living here, which is wild. It's just wild. So what do we do about that? What do you do about it?
Well,
get out of there.
I mean, well, yeah. What do we have to do now? I mean, we need to put the brakes on. And
You said it before. It's like, you know, it's the United States. United States.
Yeah, these United States.
Right.
And I quite frankly believe that, you know, leadership starts at the top. And I'm going to say it flat out, you know, and some people probably won't be happy. I don't think the current nominee from the Democrats, and I say the nominee because she didn't garner a vote, Kamala Harris is not fit to be the leader of the United States.
So say more. Why do you think that?
I don't think she's got, number one, she's got the leadership abilities. And I think right now we are in tough times as a nation. The world is in a tough time. And I believe, you know, when we look at the historical issues of Donald Trump, and quite frankly, I mean, I'm honest with you. I did not support Donald Trump when he ran in 2016 until he became the nominee from the Republican Party. I actually supported Ted Cruz. But
why do you think Trump is the right person? Or do you think Trump is the right person right now? And why do you think Trump is the right person right now?
I believe that he is the right person right now because he's a business leader. People have been critical of him because of bankruptcies and business failures and things like that. But let's face it, when you have that many businesses going on, you're going to have successes and you're going to have failures and you learn from those. And I think his biggest problem in his first term was that he had so much pushing back against him. He was not fully able or capable of getting his vision and his agenda accomplished. But when we look at the end of his term, you know, and he had COVID in his lap, you know, at the end there, which really screwed things up. The cost of living was lower. Price of fuel was lower. The price of goods were lower. The country as a whole was doing very well. In a business, from looking at things from a financial and economic perspective, and he was ending the wars. Afghanistan was the longest war we've ever been involved in.
Right. Well, absolutely. It's hard to argue with that. I mean, but what about notions of integrity and honesty? And, you know, he's... he's not the most trustworthy person. What comes out of his mouth is frequently not what is. And does that sound like I'm on Mars?
Well, show me a politician that is 100% trustworthy, 100% honest, and truthful.
And 100? Do they need to be 100? We'll never find one.
Okay, like the limit that the Republican Party uses in Wyoming is 80% to support the platform. So show me a politician that's at 80%. And
not sure there are any.
That's asking a lot sometimes. In the Republican Party in Wyoming, we get a lot of pushback asking for 80%.
So, but let me get this one out. And it seems to me that. No one does it. No, I don't care if he's the president or whatever. It's not, he is a policy guy and he can push things in one direction or another. True. But it seems to me that so much of the job of a president is to be able to unify, move people in a common direction. And given where we are right now, to heal that division so that there's, it may not be like this, but at least it's like this and not like this. But it just seems to me that Trump is so obviously not a person who values those kinds of things. That it's just hard to imagine that he's the guy at the moment that can do that. And I don't know if she is, but it just seems like it's gotten more divided and that he's part of that. Like it's almost like he thrives on it. And is that not your sense of who he is?
That's not my perception. I mean, we think about, we look at his first term. I mean, all the things that were thrown at him. We'll start off with the Steele dossier, which was proven to be false. Russian collusion. I mean, for years, the issue of campaign promise to build a wall and all the pushback he got on that. And then, we flash forward during the current president's term. It's been an open borders type thing. And, we have millions of people who are in our country illegally. And, and I come from an environment, when we looked at, we had a phrase, military age males, MAMs. Military age males, people who posed a threat to us in a combat environment, coming across the border from all these countries around the world and bypassing all the countries that they were going through to get to the United States southern border. Is it just their intent to come into the United States and be part of the melting pot? I don't know. I mean,
I completely agree with that. I agree. To me, it's, I know it's going to sound like I'm trivializing it, but I'm not. It's, you don't get to cut in the lunch line. I mean, it just everybody waits in line. It's just like you got to go through the lunch line. You don't get to cut. But when you talk about okay, we need to do something. And then there was this bipartisan bill that was everybody on both sides, including the border, the border patrol, et cetera, said, okay, this would be better. Yes, this will help. Is it everything we need? No, it's not everything we need, but this would be helpful. And Trump sort of makes sure it doesn't get passed. That's not a guy who wants to solve the problem or bring people together. And that's the part that's really hard for me to swallow about him as a presidential candidate. That's one of them.
Right. Well, I mean, his policy when he was in office, was to remain in Mexico while people were vetted. paperwork was done and they were brought into the United States.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want exploitation of children and women, you know, children and women being used for sex trafficking or being exploited in the sense of saying we're a family and we're coming across together. So it gave, you know, some breathing space. And, you know, and what the bill they were trying to create earlier this year, you know,
didn't do that.
We had 3 years of open borders.
Yeah. It didn't do that. It didn't. It wouldn't be a reinstatement of Trump's policy. But everybody involved in the border said this would be better. This would help. This would help to stem the problem. So, you know, the standing in the way of that, that's just one instance for me of like, dude, what are you doing, man? You like, we want the place to get better, don't we?
Well, it shouldn't have got bad. I mean, there was a good policy in place.
It did. I mean, like, I'm not saying that Biden's policy was a good thing. I'm absolutely not.
I mean, from my perspective, you know, the policy they were trying to put in place was not going to be effective. Mm. What really I believe should have occurred last year, earlier this year, was they should have closed the border.
Yeah.
And not encouraging these people to come to the border, to an open border like that, and closed it. And I'm not talking about putting watchtowers with machine guns on air to repel the invaders type things.
We've tried.
No, let's have entry points and people who are legally immigrating into the United States or legal refugees. It's not asking to. I mean, my family immigrated to the United States.
Mine too.
I mean, both sides, my mom and dad's side, both immigrated to the United States legally. And granted, that was over 100 years ago. Things were different.
Different times.
You know, we need to get to a point, you know, with our immigration that it needs to come under control. But, you know, back really real quick on the Donald Trump. I mean,
wasn't that a step in the direction? Wasn't that bill a step in the direction of under control?
I don't believe so, because of the damage that had been done for the past 3 years. I believe we needed to get to the point of the border needed to be shut, and anything else
was sort of just a waste of time.
The border needed to be shut.
Yeah.
These people who have come into the country illegally violated the law. But the thing is, I mean, these people came into the country illegally. The border needs to be shut. These people need to be, I hate to use the term rounded up because it sounds like in Wyoming here, like putting them in a corral.
But
we need to identify who these people are. And then establish, are they refugees or are they politically persecuted in their countries, and or did they just come here because they have some malicious intent? And we need to get the business of cleaning this up.
What do you think about the, since we just got there, and I know I'm looking at the time, I'm going to have to cut out some of the other stuff, but whatever.
Oh, that's fine.
But What about what's your point of view about the DACA kids? Well, and some of them are not kids, right? The kids who were brought over as infants, some of them, you know, babies, little kids, didn't even necessarily know they were there, that their parents weren't legal until much later. Do you think there's a reason you think the best policy is to send them back, or you think the best policy is to try and come up with a way for them to earn citizenship?
I mean, you know, we can look at it from the perspective of, I think, do you punish the child for the sins of their parents?
Right.
And, you know, and I had no interaction with anybody who was in that situation until a couple of years ago. My wife and I and some friends, we were in Mexico and, you know, catch an early plane out of Cancun to come back to the United States. And this young man came to our room to get our bags. And I said, thank you very much. And he responded, you're welcome. And he kind of surprised me because he said it.
English was really good.
Very good in an American accent.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And I said, have you lived in the United States or Canada? He said, well, actually, he says, my father and mother brought us into the United States when we were young. And he said, about 2 years ago, brought us back to Mexico to live. And so I said, so they went back to Mexico. Did they get deported? He goes, no, he just decided that they wanted to live in Mexico again. They missed, you know, living in their home country. Yeah. I said, but it wasn't your home country when you were born. I mean, you were young. You were a young child when you came to the United States. That's your country in your mind, right? And he says it is. He says, but you know, he goes, I'm learning a lot. He goes, I'm learning how to make money. I'm learning how to survive. He says, yeah, I'm picking up your bags. He says, but I'm going to college. And he says, and I'm doing well here. And so.
Well, just so you know, I mean, I've actually had a lot of exposure to the DACA, to kids from the, in that group, because as an educator, you know, I ran a school and in Los Angeles, and we had, I mean, probably 30, somewhere between 30 and 50 kids over the years who discovered when they were applying to college and trying to get financial aid, who that was the first time they heard they were not there legally because of their parents had somehow made it over the border, you know, whatever. And that, you know, could they have survived if they were deported? Probably. They were all very, you know, they were resilient kids. But was that the best use either by the United States of their talent, or did it feel justifiable, like morally, like we were doing the right thing, like if we had sent them back? I didn't end up feeling that way.
You know, and I agree with you to a certain extent. I mean, you know, I have a friend. He's from Romania. And he left Romania when he was a young teenager and has been in the United States. And he's like, my goodness, he says, I couldn't imagine going back there. I also have a nephew who was born in Rhodesia, which doesn't exist now.
Yeah.
And he was deported from there because he was white and of Portuguese descent. He and his family were all deported. They were told to get on a truck with a bag and equivalent of $10 and taken to the airport and deported.
Wow.
And he thought, gosh, he goes, if I ever had to go back there now, Zimbabwe, he said, I didn't grow up there.
Right. Exactly.
that's not my country anymore.
It's not my home.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, it's, I don't believe in punishing children for the sins of their parents. Yeah. And I think there needs to be a path. But unfortunately, you know, there's also the potential for the abuse of that.
Sure.
And I just like in our government, we need to have checks and balances to ensure that we're bringing the right people into our country and under the right circumstances. And when I say into our country, I mean citizenship. So, yeah, I think there is. I think there should be a path. And, you know, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah.
But I don't think the southern border should be wide open for people coming across that area.
Completely agree with you. And I also would want to say that kind of what is frustrating to me, and I suspect frustrating to you, is that we are living in such an overly politicized and combative time that we can't get legislators who will have the conversation that you and I are having right now.
So I'm just saying, there's many different aspects to it.
Yeah. So Vince, I we're gonna have to stop now, but I'm gonna put it out there. I hope there's a next conversation to be had. I hope there's a next conversation that we can have.
Certainly.
More things.
Like I said, I'd be willing to talk to you about anything. And if I'm not willing to talk to you about it, I would say,
I'll tell you.
No, don't want to talk about it.
Cool.
Just understand, sometimes I say things that people don't want to hear, but I think that
Have you said anything today that you think people don't want to hear?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
No, either. I think it was good. I think, you know, you and I.
I don't mean you and me. I mean.
No, I'm just saying you and I have engaged in good dialogue. And I think, you know, for those people watching, hopefully they take something away from it. And yeah. And just understand that, you know, I mean, us people who believe, you know, on the right are not that dissimilar from the people on the left. You know, it's this pendulum going back and forth. And interestingly, I pulled up something yesterday from the Cato Institute. How important are the following to you personally? And it showed Republicans and Democrats. And there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, only 6 out of about 20 issues where there was a significant difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if people stopped focusing on those extreme issues and focus more on those things that we can agree on, I think we would see a better society.
I completely agree. Completely agree. And with that, I would say thank you again for being willing to have this conversation. And I hope this is, you know, I hope there's more down the road.
I appreciate you inviting me, and I got to be quite honest with you. I had quite a few people who told me, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it.
I am so, you told me that before, and I was like, what the hell? What? Like, why?
So, I'm like, just going to have a conversation, and, yeah, and I think it's been a good conversation.
Yeah, I agree.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio. We'll be right back.